Everyone's online? Before we get started then, let us all bring our palms together to make veneration to the perfectly enlightened one, the unvanquished one, the undefeated one, our guide, our master, and our teacher. It is in his footsteps today we follow, in the hope that we can all achieve the same destination that he once did and convinced us all that was well within our reach. As we take this moment to pay veneration to the Buddha, let us also remind ourselves that this is more than a mere mark of respect, but it is a pledge of allegiance that we take to the Buddha, which represents the truth, the Dhamma, which is the path to get there, and the Sangha, which is our practice. And so, let us take a moment to reflect on our purpose here, and let us chant the Namaskara as we make a promise to ourselves to work diligently until we have all attained the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. From here on out, it's just you and me. Remember, there's no one either side of you, no one in front of you, no one behind you, no one with you. Until the end of this talk, it's just you and me. Switch off from the rest of the world for a little bit. You know, there's going to come a day where you're going to have to switch off anyway. We talked about this quite a bit last week. And the world will still go on. You are just a what paper? We settled for tissue, did we? I thought we did one better than that. So if the world can survive even when you're gone, surely the world can survive for a couple of hours without you. Don't you think so? So without being the world's slave and the world's servant for once, you become your own slave for a second. Do something for yourselves. Work on your salvation. And there is nothing that can do that besides the truth. These are not mere words when we say, the Buddha is my refuge. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dhamma. I take refuge in the Sangha. These are not just mere words that a good Buddhist must somehow utter before the beginning of a sermon or some other meritorious activity. This is the truth, ladies and gentlemen. You know your children have not been your refuge. How do you know this? You might say, well, I don't have children yet, Swami, so how can I know? Well, then go ask your parents whether you have been their refuge. And they will tell you. Perhaps they once thought that you were going to be their refuge, so they had you. They were super excited about having you. When you were just a dream in your mother's mind. You were just a dream. When you were just a dream in your father's mind, and they wanted to have you at some point, and then somehow you were there, you were born. When they first held you in their arms, they were convinced that you were their refuge. They were convinced. So they thought that from here on, we shall never cry again. They looked at that little smile on your face. Well, it was not so much a smile, but they tried to make you smile. All you knew was to cry for everything and every other thing. But behind those tears, behind those weeps and those sleepless nights, they always convinced themselves that in my arms is my refuge. And one day this child will make me so happy that I would not need anything else in my life. How wrong they were, eh? You know, it would be fair to say that there's not a single soul here, myself included, who can say that all we ever brought to our parents was joy and happiness and laughter. Anyone? What are you, an alien? Are you all in agreement with me? There's not a single person in this room who can say that. All we did was bring joy and laughter and happiness to our parents. But you know, when they wanted to have you, when you were just, what shall we say, a spark or a little star in your mother's eye, when she had dreams and when she wished for you, at that time, that's all she ever wanted. If there are parents here, or, well, the parents here, when you wanted to have a child, now maybe going back a few years now, maybe there are to-be parents here, soon-to-be parents maybe, or those who wish to become parents in the future. Usually that's how people divide you into categories, parents and to-be parents. Because seldom do you find someone who doesn't want to be a parent. It's very few and far between. I myself wanted to be a parent at one point. Never turned out. Little did I know that you've got to be careful what you wish for. I had it all planned out. I wanted two children, one boy and one girl. And then God had other plans for me. So He played a practical joke on me. Today is not two, but more like 200. But if you were ever there, when you wanted to have a child, you'll all remember, those who are parents in this room, influenced by what others had told you, influenced by what your relations, your neighbors had said, your siblings had informed you, your friends, when are you going to become a mother? This is a very common question that a girl would typically have soon after they're married, right? I think every woman in the house would have to agree. At some point after you're married, it's usually a question you get from your parents. When do we get to see a little one? So when this question is posed to you, you start imagining what life would be like with them. Because at that point you don't have them, but you have problems. That's the way it works. You don't have children, but you have problems. Has there ever been a day where you have had no problems? Has there ever been a day where you've not had any problems? No, then you are dead. So, if you were alive, then you would have had problems. No end of it. So you would have had problems but no children. And then someone would have said, you know, if only you had a child, all these problems would just disappear into thin air. Sometimes when a married couple or a couple living together, they have little arguments, disagreements, when there's just not enough, I don't know, what's the word? You know what I mean. When it's just not there, when it's lost, that spark is lost, right? And then you start bickering about one thing or the other. And then the parents get to know about this, the in-laws get to know about it, and then soon enough they say, it's time, don't you realize? And so your mother would come up to you, she'd hold you by your cheek, and then she'd probably say, if only there was another one, just a smaller version of this, how cute it would be. So they'll keep feeding all this into your mind, and in your mind you're cooking up now, because you're looking for a solution to your problem, whatever the problem might be, unpaid bills, right? You're falling out of trust, something's going wrong in the relationship, marital fidelity is gone for some reason, you don't trust each other, or you start to become suspicious of the other person. These things happen in almost every relationship. And then they say, you'll have a child and your problem will be fixed. So, now the thing is this, because you have a problem but no solution, you're always looking for one. That's what happens when the mind does not have the Dhamma. You can't be faulted for that. No one can be blamed for that. Every mind wishes to be free. It's like every prisoner wishes to be what? Freed, right? Every prisoner wishes to be freed. In the same way, a mind that suffers wishes to be freed from suffering. And can you blame? Can you fault that? Certainly not. So when there's a problem, a whole host of problems, and then you're looking for solutions but nothing seems to be working, then of course you're going to try the next thing on the agenda. And so you think a child comes along and that will fix the problem. So that's how you ended up becoming parents. So then parents in the house, I'll ask you the same question. From the day you had your children, has there never been a day you have cried, wept, lamented, been sorrowful, been angry, lost good night's sleep because of your children? Or are you speechless? You're saying, that's it, Swami Nuhasa, there's more. So, you know, we are all guilty of that. As much as we have made our parents unhappy, our children have made us unhappy. Or at least we think that they are the reason that we are unhappy. Like initially you thought they were the reason you were going to be happy, and now you say they're the reason that you're unhappy. So this is not an attack on children, by the way. My point is this. In life, when you come across these problems and you look for answers in the wrong places, one thing will only lead to another. And you'll keep spiraling down and down and down and down and down until it becomes a vicious cycle. One wrong decision will lead you to the next, and that to the next, and that to the next, and before you know it, you'll almost lose your sanity. At the monastery, we do a lot of counseling. Many young, elderly, males, females, mothers, fathers, husbands, wives, they walk through our gates every day, every single day. On some days we have around 20, 30, 40 people. Individual sessions, they come looking for solace. And when you sit down with them, it's always the same problem, ladies and gentlemen. It could take different guises, but it's always underlying the same problem. And here's the problem. They want happiness, they want freedom of mind, and they're doing the wrong thing. It's always that. They have a bucket list of things that they think, once I get through this list, I will be happy. And they think that the only thing that's standing between them and being happy is something that someone's told them they've got to do. And until they get that done, they're not fulfilled. And among these things are like things like, I want to become a mother. I want to get that house. I want to buy that car. I want to get married. I want to get divorced. Don't you see the irony? There are those who come forward and say, Swami Nansa, I'm not happy because I'm not married yet. There are others who come and say, Swami Nansa, I'm not happy because I'm not divorced yet. Does that not tell you something? I mean, to me, that speaks volumes. There are some who come and say, Swami Nansa, I'm not happy because I haven't been able to become a mother yet. And then there are others who come and say, Swami Nansa, I'm not happy because of these brags. Life was so much better without them. Why didn't I get to hear your sermons before I had them? Like it's my fault. Apparently now it's my fault that I didn't start preaching many years ago before people decided to have kids. I'm sorry. You know, what this must convince you is that we are looking for answers in the wrong places. Whether you have children or not is not what determines whether you're going to be happy. Whether you have money or not is not what's going to determine whether you are happy. Whether you're married or not is not what's going to determine whether you're happy. You're looking for answers in the wrong places, ladies and gentlemen. Every Tom, Dick and Harry, they're all looking for answers in the wrong places. You've got to be different. You've got to be different. That's what sets you apart. There are two kinds of people in this world. There are the wise and then there are the fools. In very simple terms, a fool is someone who looks for answers in the wrong places. That's when you might insult someone, hey, you fool, what are you doing? It makes no sense to do that. You might have heard yourself say to others when they're looking for answers in the wrong places. And then who's a wise man? A wise man is someone who knows what he has to be doing and he does that. He's looking for answers in the right places. Oh, he has found the answer. And therefore, the search has come to a stop. You've got to understand and you've got to decide for yourself what sets you apart from your neighbors who are yet to discover the Dhamma. Otherwise, you're both living on the same street. How are you different to each other? What sets you apart from your colleagues? The people who sit down with you on the other end of the desk or in the other end of the room and work and do the same job. What sets you apart, ladies and gentlemen? You are a mother and so is the next person you're going to bump to on the street. She's also a mother. What sets you apart? What makes you think you are wise? What qualifies? What is the qualification that you have to say that I'm a wise mother? I'm a wise man. I am a wise woman. Someone told me that next month, was it next week? In a couple of weeks' time, we're going to have International Women's Day, aren't we? Yeah, 8th of March? Yes. So, around that time, throughout the world, there are going to be plenty of conversations. People, every year, you know, they're reminded, women, we have to do something for them. Both men and women are reminded that there are women in this world and we have to do something for them. So it's a day to celebrate your feminine identity. What do we do here every Sunday morning? Mock you for your identity. Be that feminine or masculine. But then around the world, there'll be many conversations, both men and women in various circles, various forums, various groups will get together and talk about how they can put women on the same platform. how they can give women an equal platform, equal opportunities, equal privileges, remove those glass ceilings. How they should be entitled to climb up the same career ladders all the way up to the top, just as men. And how there should be gender parity and gender equality and all the rest of that. Do we have an International Men's Day? Is there one? I see this. Is there? We don't have consensus. Some say yes, some say no. Well, those who say yes, they must know that there is one. I mean, the rest of us probably don't know that. I didn't know that there was a World Men's Day. Is there?
No.
Oh. Is there? Oh, okay. 19th of November. Well, there you have it. Equal opportunities. If women are going to have an International Women's Day, then men should have the same, of course. Otherwise, once again, what's there going to be? Inequality. So this is always a race. It's always a race. This race is as old as time itself. You know, women have always felt, I can't say all of them, but the majority of them have always felt that we are somehow treated like second-class citizens. We don't have the same opportunities like men do. How come if we are the ones who bring life into this world, if we are the mothers who look after our children, if we can do all the rest of what men can do, how come we are both not treated the same? And then as soon as you start asking that question, men will come forward and they'll also start putting forward their arguments. Neither of these people are going to find peace because they're all trying to look for answers in the wrong places. That's looking for answers in the wrong places. That's because they have not sought refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha. Once you seek refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha, you realize the problem is not that. It's not that I am a woman and I'm not treated fairly. It's not that I am a man and I'm not treated fairly. The problem is, I am a woman. At least I feel like one. That's the problem. I'm just a chitta. How come my chitta takes on an identity and thinks to itself that I'm a man or I'm a woman? See, that's where you must stand out, ladies and gentlemen. Otherwise, how are you any different to the next woman you're going to bump to on the street? How are you different to any man that you're going to cross paths with? What makes you stand out? What has transformed within you for all these weeks of bringing you here every Sunday morning? What's different about you? It has to be in the way you think. You have got to be wise in that. You have got to now start looking for solutions to your problems in the right places. First and foremost, you must now have given up that bad habit of pointing your finger outwards. That's what they're all doing. On International Women's Day, what do you think women are going to be doing? You lot. You men. You don't treat us fairly. So then come November 19th, what do you think the men are going to be doing? You lot. That's what they're going to do. Always looking for answers in the wrong places. You know, that's throughout the year, you're going to have all these days. You have Teacher's Day, Parents' Day, Mother's Day, Father's Day. Do you have a Husband's Day and a Wife's Day? Not yet. Okay, it's coming then. So then we have national days. The day that we got independence. The 4th of February. Really? Did we really get independence on that day? How can you say that you're independent if you still think that you're Sri Lankan? Or you're Sinhalese? Or you're Tamil? You're trapped within your identity. See, the thing is this. Today you're Sinhalese because you were born to a Sinhalese mother. You die and then you're born to a Tamil mother. Now, what are you going to celebrate? Or let's say, you know, we were once under the colonial reign, and then, so the British gave us our freedom. So today you are born to a Sri Lankan mother and you say, we got our independence. Then the next day you are born to a British mother and you say, well, we lost Sri Lanka, Ceylon. Or how good it was when we had them. There are never any victors. There's no permanent victory until you defeat the enemy within. That's where you've got to stand out. Stand out of the crowd. You've got to think differently. You are the product of your own thoughts. What has happened to you today is what you thought yesterday. That's why you are where you are today. If you are happy today, that's because you thought the right things yesterday. If you are unhappy today, ladies and gentlemen, that's because you thought the wrong things yesterday. You are a product of your own thinking. So if you think right, you will be all right. If you think wrong, you will always be wrong. That is why we invest so much time and energy and our focus on the Noble Triple Gem, which is the only refuge, because these are the answers to life's riddles. Children is just one example. For others it could be traveling the world. For others it could be, like I said, getting married, buying property, going around, doing things, getting places. None of these things are really the answers that your mind needs. You know, I think I might have used this example in the past, but I'll use it again. You've all had nightmares at some point or the other. Anyone here who's not had a nightmare? Okay, good. So you've all had that. It's not good, but it's good for what we're trying to do here. You've all had nightmares. So when you have a nightmare, you might have, when after you've woken up, you'll hear people saying, hey, you okay? Just wake up, it was just a dream. But when you're in your dream, you don't know you're in one, do you? When you're in a dream, you don't know you're in one. So when you're having a nightmare, you don't know that it's a nightmare. Let's imagine you're in a dream and you've got, I don't know, a demon chasing you or something. Or the whole world's gone on fire and you're in it. Right? Something, some terrible dream. Or there's some crazy man chasing you, or maybe some wild, ferocious animal that's running after you and you're running for your life. So, in your dream, you'll start screaming, and sometimes people even hear it. So, when you scream in your dreams, when you have these nightmares, what does a good friend do? What does a good friend do? They wake you up. They wake you up. They wake you up. Why? Because it's just a dream, right? But whilst you're in your dream, you don't know that it's a dream, do you? But and you feel like what's happening is happening for real. You feel like what's happening is happening for real. In fact, as soon as you wake up, if they took your pulse, what would it be? It'd be really fast, yeah. Your blood pressure would go up, you'll start sweating, yeah? And you would, you know, your body would respond in the same way it would had that situation happen in real life. So when you're in a dream, you can't tell the two apart. That's why nightmares are so scary. I mean, if you knew that you were dreaming, it wouldn't be so bad, would it? When you're in a nightmare, if you knew that it was a nightmare, it wouldn't be so bad. But what makes a nightmare so terrible is that you don't know it's one. That's what makes it terrible. And so whenever you're looking for answers to that problem, let's say there's a huge serpent chasing you and you're in a dream. Now you might try climbing up a tree. And then as you put your foot on one of the branches, the branch breaks. So this is in a dream, right? And then you look for another tree. So you run fast to that tree, you try to climb that tree up, and again the branches break. Or there are more serpents on the tree. Right? So, I mean, I could just keep on going all day, because this is just a dream. You can invent anything. It's as rich as your imagination. But it's a dream. So every solution that you take to escape from whatever is about to happen, this imminent danger in a dream, is only a waste of time. Don't you agree? When you're in a dream, whatever steps you take to escape from imminent threat, imminent danger, is a waste of time. Because the moment you escape from one danger, what does the dream do? It creates another. And the moment you escape from that, it creates another. That's how you have, sometimes for several minutes, maybe even for an hour or so, a terrible dream. And then you wake up and you realize, oh, thank God, that was just a dream. You sigh. You sigh in relief. So a good friend's job then is to wake you up from your dream. Because I'll tell you why. Dreams are not so bad if you knew that it was a dream. Then you could just let anything happen. You say someone's walking up to you with a gun. If you knew it was a dream and they threatened to shoot you, what are you going to say? Just imagine you know it's a dream. Then what would you say? Shoot all you like, it's only a dream. Now you have anaconda coming at you. I made the bad mistake once when I was young. I watched this film called Terminator. That's the day I by-hearted this stanza. What was it? It was the tip of my tongue a moment ago and I can't remember it now. It'll come to me in a moment. So it was a stanza because I was so scared after I'd watched Terminator, because Arnold Schwarzenegger, the actor, he comes out of the molten fire. There's a fire and he comes out. He's a robot. If any of you have watched it. So he's shot and then he comes out because he's just a robot. So he can put himself back together again. And that was just so scary for me. And I was only 8 or 9 or something like that. I shouldn't have watched that. I don't know what I was thinking. But I watched it anyway. And then, now I remember. Set Siridena Mahaguna Muhudana. That's the day I learned that gatha. Because I just couldn't fall asleep. I was so scared. And my mother brought the book to me and she said, learn this one and you'll be fine. So I couldn't fall asleep that day. I was so scared. And then in my dreams, I was seeing the Terminator. And I didn't know that it was just a dream. So I would wake up dead scared, sweating. It happened for a few days until my mind began to realize that it was not real. So I've had that experience. And you might have had similar where you watched a horror movie. Any horror movie fans? I don't know why. If any of you have watched a horror movie or something like that and then you have a bad dream, and then you curse yourself for having watched it, but then it's too late because all that's already in your head, you can't get it out now. But the worst part of it is, when you're in your dream, you don't know you're dreaming. That's the worst part of it. Like I say, if you knew it was a dream, then you could just say, do whatever you want, I don't care. A drunken elephant is coming at you. Anything. So, you see, in your dreams, it's so bad because when you're scared, when you have a problem, you take the wrong solution. You look for the wrong solution. You look for the wrong answers. That's why you have to wake up. And waking up is the only right answer you need. You don't need to do anything else. Once you're woken up, you need not do anything else, do you? Once you're woken up, you needn't do anything else. Because everything that happened in your dream is now gone. Just like that. Because now, that was the right answer. Waking up is the right answer to a nightmare. Do you have any other right answers to a nightmare? If a nightmare is a problem, what's the only right answer? Waking up. So, everything else is a wrong answer. Well, then in the same way, ladies and gentlemen, when you suffer internally, when your mind suffers, there can only be one right answer. Every other answer is a wrong answer. Now, ask yourselves this question throughout your lives, for however long you have been alive. How many times did you take the right answer? How many times did you take the wrong answer? You've lost count by now. Isn't your life itself just a long tale that tells you that tells you here are all the wrong answers to be taken for a problem? You know, if you were to write your life, so your biography, if you were to write down your autobiography and you went back and read the pages, every time you had a problem and the answers you took to those problems, how much of it would you be proud today, and how many of those pages would you actually publish as a book? Now that you have listened to the Dhamma, now that you have learned and listened to the Dhamma, how many of you would be happy to actually publish your life story? If in that book you had to make public every time you had a problem and the solutions you took to resolve those problems, I certainly wouldn't do it if it was down to me and my lay life. I wouldn't do it. Because in those pages will be things like this. I felt lonely at this point in my life, so I thought I should get myself a girlfriend. That's not a story worth telling. That's not a story worth telling. Because, you know, if that was a story I told, the title of this book could be A Fool's Guide to Life. I was bored, so I thought I'd get myself a TV. I was bored, so I thought I'd go watch a movie. I was bored, so I thought I'd go and party with my friends. Each of those things, ladies and gentlemen, are the wrong answers. You know that they're the wrong answers because you've done it time and time and time again. And every single time, you are still back where you started. You know, if there's a path that takes you back where you started, what do you call that path? It's a very simple question. It's not rocket science, come on. A path that takes you back where you started, what's it called? What's it called? A circle. When you think of samsara, what shape comes to mind? A circle. Why? Why? Because it's a dog chasing its own tail. That's why. If there's a path that takes you back where you started, then you're taking the wrong path to solve a problem. The right path should look something like this. Here's a problem. Here's a solution. But look at this path. Look at this path that you've taken. See, I'm bored. So what do? I call my friends. I ring a friend. And then they say, what shall we do? I've got the day free. How are you about you? I've got the day free as well. Well, how about let's go watch a movie? All right, good. Let's go watch a movie. So you go watch a movie. And then once the movie comes to an end, then they say, you're still bored because now the movie's come to an end. Shall we get something to eat? Yeah, let's go grab something to eat. So you go grab something to eat. So once you grab something to eat, then they say, well, what shall we do now? Well, shall we go home? Go to your place? Yeah, sure, let's go to my place. Go to your place. So what do we do now? Because you all have to do something, because you're bored. Right, so what shall we do now? Well, shall we invite a few others to come over? Yeah, sure, let's do that. Let's invite a few others to come over. So you've invited a few others to come over. So once they're over, now you have to greet them, you have to entertain them. So let's get some food, some drinks, whatever, right? And then, so of course, the day is coming to an end. Everyone has to go back home. You know, tomorrow's a work day. So then they all go back home. And you're back where? You're back where you started, because you're lonely again. So, you're lonely again. So the following day, what must you do? Lonely? Bring some friends, go watch a movie, grab something to eat, come home with your mates, invite the rest of them around, then greet them, treat them, and then they go home again, and you're lonely. You tell me, how many times have you invited your friends around throughout your life? Countless times. I mean, you can't count them on the fingers of your hands. Countless times you've invited your friends over. You invited them over because you wanted their companionship. You were bored, you were lonely. It was nice to have them around, you know, exchange niceties, talk with them, have some food together, and then they go back and then you're lonely again. See, you can keep doing this until your friends are interested in you. This is why I gave a warning to the parents in the room last week. You can do this until your friends are interested in you, and then as your peers start to age and then they can't get themselves out of their homes, you'll be at the mercy of your children. And then when your children are too busy to come and see you because they have their own parties to go to, then you'll just be a lonely old granny or a lonely old granddad. And then there'll just be the two of you. That's why in most homes, when the children have lived with the parents and then they've left their home, just the two people remaining, when one dies, the other one soon follows. Why? What happens? It kills them inside. Because now boredom takes over. Then they start getting depressed. The will to live is lost. And that's not because, if people say that's because I they were so much in love, they just couldn't live without each other. That's not what it is. You know, we've talked about what love is in the past. It's only a creation of your own mind. You don't know whether someone loves you or not. You're just an island. Remember? We talked about this. How can you tell whether someone loves you or not? How much does someone love you? How can you tell? Does your husband love you? Does your wife love you? How can you tell? That's why you have to go ask them, do you love me? Why do you have to ask if you can tell whether they love you or not? Love is basically an emotion that you have to create in your own mind. So you take evidence that you believe is evidence of love, right? And then you create it in your own mind. So you cook it up in your own mind. But what I'm saying, that this is why when a pair lives together and the children have left their home, then usually what happens is once one passes away, the other soon follows suit. It's because internally they begin to die. And the minds are looking for that companionship, that spark that kept them going, and then now it's gone, and so therefore they just can't do it anymore. So you see, this is the wrong solution to a problem, to a real life problem. Wrong solution. Take hunger. You can throw anything at this, ladies and gentlemen. Take hunger. This is a physical problem. When you're hungry, what do? You cook, or you buy some food and you eat, right? After a while, you're hungry again. Every problem in life you consider, it's going to be the same story. So actually, whilst samsara is an endless loop, samsara itself is an endless loop, because what you do in samsara is an endless loop. That's why. If you did the right thing for once, your samsara would look like this. Usually, here's what happens. I think I drew it right the first time. This is usually what happens. People keep going round and round and round and round, and at some point they take refuge in the Noble Triple Gem. And then what happens? You break out of that loop. and it comes to a stop. If you're still in this loop, you are no different to the next man you meet on the street. Everyone's stuck in this. Literally everyone. Everyone besides those who have seen the Dhamma. What are we doing here every Sunday morning? Every Sunday morning, you come here because you want to learn how to break out of this loop. This is an endless loop. There'll be those here who believe in life after this. And there'll be those here who don't believe in life after this. It doesn't matter. To me, it doesn't matter. For the purpose of what we are sharing here, it doesn't really matter, ladies and gentlemen. Whether you believe in the afterlife or not, matters not. Because there's one problem you have whether there's a life after this or not. In this life itself, this is what you're doing. You don't need anyone else to convince you that you do this in this life itself, right? Even in this life that you have today, you still keep doing the same thing. When you want to watch TV, it's the same thing. See, is there anything that you can think of as an example which you were happy just doing it once, you did it once and then that's it, you needn't do it again? Is there anything you can come up with an example? We started this conversation with having children. Right? So you have a child. So how come you have the second child then? If a child is supposed to make you happy, my mother had two children. This is a question I have for her now. She had me first and then she had my little brother. So if I was the one who was going to make her happy, how come she had a second one? What does that tell? What does that tell you about me? I couldn't make her happy. So she thought, she'll try again. Take marriages. Some people get married, then they get divorced. What do they do again? Some get married again. Because they think that it was that man or that woman who was the problem. She was not right, he was not right, but marriage is right. That's what they think. Marriage is right. Trying to find happiness from another person, that concept is right. It's just that I found the wrong person. So as soon as I find the right person, it'll all be fine. That's what they think. So you keep going around in the same loop. So ask yourself the question, please. Are you still stuck in these loops? Or is it time you realized that you need to break out of this loop? This is a question you have to ask and answer yourself. Be responsible, be accountable to yourself. That's ultimate accountability, when you're accountable to yourself. Be accountable to yourself, ladies and gentlemen. You know, the world is not interested in you taking this path, because then you exit from this world. You become irrelevant to this world. Every player in the world is in this loop. This is in one of these loops. You are a part of this world for as long as you are in this loop. If you want to come out of this world, you have to exit this loop and take this trajectory out of the loop. So where are you? I asked the question. That's why I said you and I are the only ones in this room right now. I'm not asking you what your families do. Plan to do. I'm not asking you whether your children are doing this, whether your spouses are doing this, or your parents are doing this, because, okay, let's say your father, he's now taken the exit, but you're going around in a loop. What good does that do to you? Nothing. Each of us came into this loop alone, right? And each of us are going to exit alone. Whilst you're here, there'll be other loops that will, you know, these are like concentric circles. There'll be other people who'll also be looping. You can hold hands while you do that. But the moment when it comes, you have to exit, you have to go alone. So you came alone, you have to go alone. Name one thing, if you can, that you do in the world where, as a solution to a problem that you have, which actually takes you out of this loop. Everything that we do in our lay lives, And sometimes even in a monk's life, if you're not mindful of what you're doing. Take for example this, right? Say I'm preaching to you because I enjoy preaching, not because I'm interested in Nibbana. If I came up to you and started preaching to you because I enjoy preaching, I would also be stuck in another loop. Because every day there will be another audience, and I'll just keep on preaching and preaching and preaching and preaching. There's no exit. So whilst I'm preaching, in my mind I've got to tell myself why I'm preaching in the first place. Why are we discussing the Dhamma? Why are we talking the Dhamma? Think about studying the Dhamma. Just imagine we were just interested in the Dhamma. We studied the Dhamma, but not for our salvation. If you and I were there, that would again be just another loop, like any other kind of education. There'll be several of you in this room who have reached the pinnacle of your academic career. Say some of you are PhD holders. Now for a moment, if you believe that there is life after this one, can you take your PhD with you when you go? So you're going to have to start again. You learned how to tie your shoelaces, didn't you? Yeah, so you're going to have to learn that again. Everything you have learned so far, you'll have to learn again. What does that tell you? You're still stuck in a loop. So whether that is feeding your hunger, quenching your thirst, these are physical needs, or psychological needs, watching TV, listening to music, talking to friends, partying, entertaining yourself, whatever the case might be, if what you're doing is just going around in a loop, ladies and gentlemen, it's just a waste of time. You are never going to find a real long-lasting solution. And that is why it is imperative that you focus your efforts on finding your exit. This is like a roundabout. You can just keep going round and round and round the merry-go-round. You've got to find your exit. This exit comes one day when you're listening to the Dhamma. I don't know when that day will come for you. It will come for you whenever it comes to you. You need merits for that. You need to pay attention to what is being taught. You need to use the Dhamma and apply it to understand that this is actually what has been going on in your life. That reflection, internal reflection. Because here's the thing. You've got to fall out of love with this process. You've got to lose interest in this. You have to become disinterested, dispassionate about this loop. Otherwise, you're not going to come out of it. Because no one's actually putting you through the loop. It's your own thinking that keeps you in the loop. It's your own thinking. So if you have your eyes closed, who's keeping you in the dark? You yourself. No one else is keeping you in the dark. So how do you come out of the darkness if you have your eyes closed? You just open your eyes. That's all you got to do. So no one's keeping you in samsara. It's your own choice. So no one's causing you to suffer. It's your own choice. When you feel anger, when you experience anger, you create your own anger. No one makes you angry. Anger is created in the mind. When you feel jealousy, no one creates jealousy. No one puts jealousy into you. You create it in your own mind. You cook it up in your own mind. When you feel lonely, no one creates that in your mind. You create it in your own mind. No one puts it in there. When you feel sad, when you feel rejected, when you feel like everyone's ignoring you, people are just neglecting you, right? When you feel neglected, we've all had these experiences in our lives. Just imagine you walk into a room and everyone is drinking, dancing, enjoying themselves, but no one seems to be interested in you. How do you feel at that time? You feel like the odd one in the room, right? And then what do you feel like doing? Walking up to someone and striking up a conversation, right? You've all been there. I remember when I used to be at work, they had these things called networking. So it was something you had to do. You had to go and talk to people, exchange business cards, see how they're doing, the lot. So if you walked into a room and no one's talking with you, people are just talking with each other, then you have to walk up to someone and say, "Hey, how are you doing? What's going on? Who are you? I'm so and so." So, and then make yourself look for recognition. Have yourself acknowledged. Because we don't like it when no one acknowledges us. We don't like it when people don't recognize us. That's why they have competitions. You know, just think about all these folks for a second. From a very young age, right, we have learned to compete. We've been taught to compete. It's kind of like part of our systems now. People think it's part of our DNA. It's not really part of our DNA. We've been taught to compete. Because there's a desire in the mind for recognition. And what competition allows you to do is to earn recognition. Otherwise, just think about it for a second. How come, you know, why do they have the Olympics? Just think about it for a second. I know it's an international event, you know, everyone comes together. That part I get. Right? Everyone comes together, it's sport. Right, they celebrate sport. I get all that. Sport is good because it's good for the body. But why should you stand 10 people on a racetrack, draw a line, and then say at the sound of 3 that you should run, and the first person to cross a line, they get recognized? Why? Why do you have to do that? I mean the competition part, not the exercise part. I mean, I get this. Let's say they had the Olympics, everyone come, everyone's on a racetrack, and they just run. Just randomly run. For exercise. I mean, it gives you what you need physically still. Right? You get the adrenaline pumping, you get your body's moving, right? All that is still happening. You're breathing, all that's good. But why do you have to stand at a line and then the first person to cross a line, they get recognized? What's that recognition for? Why is it that right from during our school years, we were taught to compete in a classroom? Why do parents ask their children, "What rank are you in the class? Are you first, second, third? What's your rank?" This is because the mind always looks for that recognition. And recognition is not something you get from someone else. Recognition is a feeling that you cook up in your own mind. That's the irony of it. As much as you might like to think, you know, that people recognize you, people respect you. No. Maybe they do, but there's no way you can pick up someone else's respect. All right, look at me and tell me whether I respect you or not. Right, at the count of 3, you tell me whether I respect you or not. Okay? 1, 2, 3. Do I? I don't? Huh? You don't know. So I say, "Sir." "Good morning, sir." "Madam." "Good morning, madam." Now am I respecting you? So say I say, "Good morning, sir," to your face. Huh? And then I talk to you and be very polite, and then you turn around, you walk away. And then as soon as you walk away, I turn to the guy next to me and go, "Fool." As long as you don't see me doing that, right, what are you going to go and tell people about me? That I'm very respectful. Yeah? But was I not pretending all along? You don't know this, ladies and gentlemen, but it happens to you all the time in society. People do it to you all day, all night long. To your face, they will give you one story, and you walk around and walk away. It's just a completely different script. I'm not saying everyone's like that, but it happens a lot more than you like to admit. And then you think that they have respected you. You know, you walk into the supermarket, someone holds the door open for you and they say, "Are you Bohan?" And then you feel very respected. You forget that it's not something they gave you, but you created in your own mind. It's because you don't understand. You think it's something they gave you. That's not how it works. How can respect be transferred? What's your organ or faculty that picks up respect? You have some kind of antenna, respect antenna? How does it, what device do you have on you to pick that up? See, one of the first things I want for you all to be able to do, and I want you to be competent in this, highly competent in this, that is to recognize one thing first. That is, everything you perceive is a creation of your own mind. It's so vital in this journey of coming out of this loop for you to recognize that you are just an island. No one's ever come in, no one's ever walked out. You are dead alone in this island of yours. That's why lately I've been talking about this quite a bit with you all. Because I need you to come out of this loop. Not because I say so, but because you recognize that being stuck in this loop is doing you no good. You're stuck in this loop, ladies and gentlemen, because you're fooled. Not by someone else. You're fooling yourself. A couple of weeks ago I asked you, is the reason you can't leave your folks behind because they love you? How do you know? What do you mean by love? When you say, my wife loves me, my husband loves me, what do you mean by that? Take a moment to study that for a second. What do you mean by that? How can you ever pick up the love that someone else feels for you? Do you plug them into you or something? Like you hold someone else's hand and then they, you know, someone holds your hand and they grasp it firmly. And that makes you feel like they love you a lot. How? How so? These are all emotions you cook up in your own mind. Come on. Acknowledge that. Acknowledge that for heaven's sake. Acknowledge that. Whatever you perceive is your own making. If ever you feel fear, it's your own making. Because fear is not in the outside world. No one can transfer fear to you. Fear has to be cooked within your own mind. That's why we have those who are the fearless. How can you scare an arahant? You can't because, well, you can't scare anyone for that matter. Scare is not something you can give someone. It is something that happens in one's own mind. You can't make someone lustful. Now, think about this for a second. Parents, right? One of the things that you try and protect your children is from lewd TV programs, commercials, things you see on the internet, pornography and those kind of things, right? Do you know the reason you have to do that? The reason you have to do that is because both you and maybe even your children still believe that it is a naked woman that gives off that sensuality. And that sensuality somehow emanates from her and goes into your mind. That's not how it works. There are no lust. Lust is not in the body. Lust is not something that someone else can create in your mind. Lust is something that happens in your own mind. You create it. See, think of this for a second. Imagine a time when you're really scared about something. You have an exam just around the corner, right? Or you've just been informed that you've got some kind of disease, right? Or something. Something's just really scared you. In those moments, someone tries to walk up to you and tries to make you feel loved, right? Or makes you feel sentimental. You don't resonate with that at that time. You might even say, cut it out, I'm not interested, I'm not in the mood for that right now. What does that mean? If what you're experiencing is something that someone else can transfer to you, how come that can't be transferred at any point in time? How come there are only certain times in your life where you're receptive to certain things and not in the other times? How come there are times where you don't resonate with people and those emotions? Say someone's trying to be really, you know, they just want to cuddle up to you or be very loving with you or whatever, right? But say you've had a really tough day at work. And then what do you normally say? Not today. Just not in the mood for that. You see, but if you are going to tell me that these emotions are emotions that other people can give to me, then why does it matter what mood you're in? You should just be able to be replaced. Right? Put out that mood, put in this mood. It doesn't work like that. It's because you don't feel that way. Meaning, that feeling of that lovingness or that affection is all cooked up in whose mind? In your own mind. So if it's all cooked up in your own mind, tell me one thing you know about the person sat next to you. Tell me one thing you know about someone else. You don't know the first thing about anyone else in this world, because your perception is all you're aware of. Your perception is your consciousness, and your consciousness is your perception. That's it. You know your thoughts, and that's all you know. Nothing more. You know color doesn't exist in objects, right? Shall I give you a challenge then? Just to convince you that you are utterly at the mercy of your own thoughts. We have discussed this in the past, that color is not in the object. Okay? So then you know as a fact that black is not here. Yes? And red is not here. Yes? Okay? So if red isn't here, stop seeing red. That's your challenge. Go on. Okay, stop seeing black. Because black isn't here, you know that. Yeah? Then stop seeing it then. You can't close your eyes. You got to look at this, but not see the cap in black. So then you're asking me, what color should I be seeing, Swami Nas? No, that's what I'm saying. That's exactly what I'm saying. Stop seeing color. Color is not in the object. All in agreement? You all agree color is not in the object? Well, if color is not in the object, then stop seeing color for a second. Just for a second, don't worry. You can see it. You can start seeing it again soon and after. But just for a second, stop seeing color. Can you? Can you? You can't. Then what does that tell you? You are at the mercy of your own thoughts. Whatever the mind cooks up, that's all you can experience. Nothing more. And nothing less. So if the mind sees green, you can't stop seeing green. See, I dare you, stop seeing green for a second. Okay, see yellow, stop seeing green and see yellow for a second. You can't. Because the mind is right now cooking up green. That's why you can't not see green. So the point is, you are completely at the mercy of whatever your mind is at this point. Whatever your consciousness is, whatever you perceive, that is what you are at the mercy of. In which case, ladies and gentlemen, your being stuck in this loop is entirely down to your own thoughts. So then you can never be pointing your finger at others saying, you're the ones who make me unhappy, you make me angry, you make me sad, you disappoint me. You can't say any of those things, because all of those are emotions that you create in your own mind. These are all conjured up in their own mind. So don't be fooled. That's why I say, this is vital. This part is crucial for your salvation. That is this: you are alone. Whatever you perceive is only in your consciousness. Your perception is what you conceive, and your consciousness is your perception. Come to terms with that for a second. Accept that. Not because I say so, but because I have given you evidence of that. Acknowledge that, please. for your own sake. Because until you do that, you will always be telling yourself, you will always be taking comfort in a lie. And that is, you have all these people around you. I have my wife with me, I have my husband with me, I have my children with me, I have my colleagues with me, I have my relations with me, I have my sister with me, I have my brother with me, I have all these friends with me. You don't have any of those things with you. No one's with you. And then you'll tell me, my husband loves me. No. Actually, the truth is this. It's impossible for your husband to love you. Let me elaborate. It's impossible for your husband or your wife to love you. And here's why. You can never arise in your husband's or wife's mind. Let's take two people, right? A and B. Okay? A thinks that B loves A. That's what they think. This is fundamentally flawed because A can never arise in B's mind and B can never arise in A's mind. When you think of something, you think of your own creation, not the person out there. Once again, the challenge. If what you're really looking at is the leaf that's in my hand, then stop seeing it in green. Are you following this trail? Or are you lost? You look a bit confused. I'll try again. Right now, hear me out. And listen attentively, because this is a very salient point. It'll help you to come out of this loop. Is green in the leaf? Is color in this object? No. There's chlorophyll here, yes. But chlorophyll is not green. All it does is it reflects light energy that falls on this, and your receptors in the back of your retina, they pick up light energy, which in turn translates to color in your minds. Color is not in the eye, color is not in the optic nerve, color is not in the object. Okay? Right. So then, if you are capable of seeing this leaf as it is in my hand, you must be able to see it without color. Do you get that? If that didn't make sense, just put your hand up for a second. I'll explain it again. If it didn't make sense, okay. Right. Let's go through that again. Objects don't have color. They have pigments. A pigment can only do one thing. A pigment cannot give color out. What a pigment does is it absorbs some amount of energy that's available in the environment, and it reflects some of that energy back out. That's what pigments do. When the eye picks up these energies, it's stimulated. Those energies travel down your optic nerve to your brain, and then during the interface between your brain and your mind, color is born. So color is not a phenomenon that exists in the outside world. All okay with that? So once again, color is not a phenomenon that exists in the outside world. Alright? Okay. So then, when you look at this leaf, you see green right now, don't you? If you're seeing green, you must be convinced of this. What is it? It's not this leaf as it is that you're seeing right now. Why do I say that? Because if you're seeing the leaf as I have it in my hand, you cannot be seeing it in color. Basically, what you're doing is you're seeing the leaf and then some. You're adding your own stuff onto this leaf. The color part, I don't hold green in my hand. I'm only holding a leaf in my hand. You add the color. Agreed? Okay, so if you are supposed to see just what I was holding in my hand, what must you see this as? Color? Less. Yes? Okay. So, by virtue of that, by extension of that, we must all agree then that what you see is not really what's in the outside world. What you see is maybe something from the outside world, but then you add your own dimensions to it. You add your own detail to it, your own decoration to it, your own whatever you do, you add stuff to it, attributes to it. So there is no way that you can see this leaf as it is. Do you all agree with me on that? Yes? All understood? Perfect. If that is so, ladies and gentlemen, you should now be convinced that you cannot see exactly what I'm holding in my hand. What you're actually seeing is an interpretation, a mental interpretation, a mental impression, if you like, of whatever is going on in the outside world. So much so that you cannot be faulted for doubting whether I actually have a leaf in my hand or not in the first place. How do you know that I have anything in my hand? Because how do you know how much of the real world and how much of your own world you're mixing together in your mind? To what proportions you're doing it, how do you know? I'll give you an analogy to make sense. Let's say, say you go to a cafeteria and you order a coffee. Okay? So they deliver the coffee to your desk, to your table, and they also bring sugar. Now you're talking with some friends, and one of the people you're with in your group, what they do is they think they're doing you a favor, and then they start adding sugar to your beverage. So after that you take your cup and you start drinking it. Now it is sweet because they've added sugar to it. At this point, I have a question for you. Can you tell me now how much sugar was in the tea before it got to you, or the coffee before it got to you, and how much sugar was added by your friend? Can you do that now? Why not? Why not? It's because you were not watching them as they did it. Right? You did not taste the drink before they started adding sugar to it. So there is no scientific way you could tell for certain how much sugar was in the drink originally versus how much sugar you've added to it, how much sugar was added to it later. So you now take the drink and drink it, you could be completely mistaken, entirely. You could think it came without sugar and it was your friend who added all of the sugar. What else could you think? That is how it came from the counter. And no sugar was added to it because you were looking away. Yeah? So there's no way you can tell what proportion of that sweetness was there originally versus how much was added to it additionally. Okay? Right. What do you see? A green leaf. So what proportion of what you see was there in the original object, and what proportion of it did you add yourself? What proportion of this was there originally, and what proportion of this detail have you added yourself? You tell me, what percent? 10%? 20? 50? How can you? You can't say. Because the mind with which you perceive this has already done all that. By the time you drink the drink, by the time you take a sip of the drink, what has happened to it has already happened. So by the time you perceive this object, it is already with color. Now you don't know how much of that detail has the mind added to it versus how much of that detail it actually came from the outside world. Well, then you tell me, what do you know for certain about the world you live in? Shall I ask you a question to give you a headache? What's reality? What's real? Is this really green? am I really holding this? Is there really something here? How much of this are you actually cooking up right now? Versus how much of this is actually reality? What is reality then? Reality is your own perception of reality. Whatever your mind conjures up, that is your world. So if it's your mind that's cooking up all this, how can you say with any amount of certainty what's going on out there? You heard that? What was it? A sound. Where did it come from? Did I project that sound? You must be able to say with 100% certainty that it was I who projected that sound. Did I project that sound? Here's what you'll do. You'll ask a few people around you. Did you also hear that? So if a few people around you agree, yes, we also heard that, then you'll tell me, well, Swaminas, if they all heard that, then surely it must have been a common source. Right? So you must have put that to me. But the point is this. This person that sat next to you, the person from whom you're asking this question, how do you know that they actually exist? I mean, before you ask the question, whether they actually heard the sound, how do you know that the person that you're going to ask this question from actually exists? What is your base? What is your most basic foundation on which you can start building up the rest of it? How can you be certain of anything in this world if all of what you perceive are mere concoctions of your own mind? How can you be certain of anything outside the remit of your mind? So then we have to come to a conclusion. You can never be sure about anything that's out there. Never. It may be what I perceive, it may not be what I perceive. But you can be certain of one thing. What you perceive is what you perceive. Perception happens. But whether what you perceive is true or not, that there's no way of validating. But that does not throw a spanner in the works in terms of you attaining Nibbana. In fact, it helps you. It helps you how? It helps you by elevating your wisdom, your knowledge, your understanding, your worldview of the world, by bringing to your conscience that all you perceive is your consciousness. You are an island. By extension of that, you must now understand then what I said to you earlier. There is nothing in this world that anyone can make you feel. Feelings cannot be transferred. Least of all, love. Least of all, anger. Least of all, lust. But now think about what people do out there. Sometimes, you know, I'm thinking of a polite way of putting this. Because I trust you, I don't know who's listening to these talks online, so once they go online, so I've got to be careful what I say and what I don't say. There are various fashion trends out there, aren't there? Which are designed to to excite people. to excite emotions such as lust in people. If you've ever seen one of these sights, if you've ever witnessed something like that, unless you look at it from this perspective, your fool's mind will tell you that those are things that are transferred to me from the outside. That there is a lot of lust in that person or in the way that they dress, and that is what is being transferred to me, and so I must close my eyes if I am a virtuous person. That's why parents try as much as they can to try and keep their children safe from these things by either shutting down the internet or forbidding them from looking at these sites. Now just imagine if a woman who was, say, half naked walked into this room right now, and if Swaminathan, say, had to look away to stop feelings of lust, okay? Don't you think that there's something really wrong with that? It's fair for me to look away if lust was something that was coming to me from that object. And until I believe that it is the object that brings me that, I will forever have to demand that you dress appropriately, because I am at your mercy. So no short dresses, no low-cut tops, none of that, because you will be transferring lust to me. And I'm a weak soul. I'm weak. So please don't take away my virtue. I don't subscribe to that, because I have sought refuge in the Noble Triple Gem. I understand today that lust is not something that can be transferred from someone to me. It is something that is created in the mind itself. I will give you one more piece of evidence to convince you, ladies and gentlemen. Someone could be dressed up in that way, say, you know, in a way that is very revealing, let's say. Okay? And when they see a person who's dressed up like that, the observer might have such lustful thoughts. But the same lust does not arise in the person who's dressed like that, does it? I remember when I was back in the UK, some of my friends, or at least I thought they were my friends, they tried to convince me to come with them to a strip club. But my merits were strong. And I was always very open with my parents, right from the beginning. So somehow I was saved from that. Today, I know what a strip club is, and I know what they do there. But today I'm able to understand what actually happens there. See, at one of these clubs, there'll be people dancing around a pole, and they'll be trying to ignite the fire of desire in people's minds. Conventionally, people will think that those thoughts are created in someone's mind by the person, the man, the woman, whoever is on the stage who's giving the performance. Is that right or wrong? That's wrong. The artist, let's call them the artist, the performer, he or she may have an intention to do that. That's possible. He or she might have an intention to ignite such feelings in the mind of the observer. Yeah, that's possible. But whatever that intention might be, it's not possible. That's like, say, you say you have an intention to touch the moon. Just because you have an intention doesn't mean it's possible. Not from Earth. You'll have to get on a rocket to go to the moon. So just because they have an intention doesn't mean it's going to materialize. So if someone who observes or who's in that environment, in that situation, they see a performer on a platform, on a stage, who's doing their thing, and then they feel feelings of lust, I'm not going to ask who's at fault. I'm going to ask who's responsible for those feelings. Is it the person who's on the platform or is the person in the audience? It's the person in the audience. Because lust is not an emotion. It's not a feeling that can be transferred from the stage to the audience. The girl who's performing does not feel that way. I mean, if those feelings were transferred, then who should be feeling it the most? The person who has it. It should be felt with maximum intensity at the source. But it's not. She's probably just doing her job. She's probably just thinking, you know, how much money am I going to earn at the end of the day? For her, it may be a business transaction that she's just doing her job. She doesn't have those feelings, potentially. But the person who's observing her, they have all these feelings and they think that these feelings are being transferred from the stage to the audience. I need you to come out of that thinking. Come out of that. Otherwise, you're no different to the man in the strip club. See, if you can understand what I'm trying to get across to you here, ladies and gentlemen, you will never become prey. You will never become victims. That's how an arahant remains unshaken. It doesn't matter what people come and do in front of them. Tanha, rati and raga. They try to perform all these sorts of antics. And the Buddha was not even the Buddha still. He was just about to become the Buddha. But he remained unshaken. Because by that point he was beginning to realize lust is not something that tanha, rati or raga can transfer to me. It's just something that I cook up in my own mind. And if I don't want it, then I don't cook it. You don't cook what you don't want to eat, do you? So then what about fear? Another thing that torments people, fear. You're scared of something. See, phobias is another one. See, as we start to understand how the mind works, we are able to now expand our scope to see who else we can help. Now, this is an area of study that we are working on. How can we help people who have phobias? People who are scared of spiders. Now at the monastery we have a little boy. He's scared of scorpions. Just the sight of one is enough to put him into a fit. So I've been talking with this child recently. And I'm trying to help him come out of that phobia. By helping him understand that the fear that he experiences is not something that comes from the scorpion. It's not something that comes from being in closed spaces. It's not something that comes out of being at a height. And people are scared of heights. Others are scared of, people are scared of all sorts, right? Of blood, needles. Anyone fainted? People here, you know, I'm sure there'll be some who are scared of various things. You'll have your own phobias. I also have a phobia. I have a phobia against ignorance and attachment. I'm dead scared. When ignorance and attachment come my way, I run a mile. So if you have a phobia, you should now begin to realize there are some answers coming your way. It's not about closing your eyes and running away. It's not about looking away. Those are very, I don't know, to me they seem like primary answers or like Montessori answers to real problems. Fear cooks up in the mind. Anger. If you're a victim of anger, and when I say a victim of anger, I don't mean the one who gets told off, who gets shouted at. Because anger punishes the angry. Yes? Yes. You're not punished for your anger, you're punished by your anger. Because anger punishes the angry. So if you are a victim of anger, I'm not talking about the one who gets shouted at, I'm talking about the one who shouts. So then you're all there at some point or the other. When anger comes in your mind, come to your senses. You know, this is meditation. You want to know what meditation is? This is meditation. Reflecting the truth. Reflecting upon the truth. Contemplating the truth. This is how I want you to spend your week, ladies and gentlemen. You only come here on a Sunday morning and that's fine. But the rest of the week, contemplate these things. If you're someone who's prone to being angry, if you're typically a victim of anger, think about these things for a second. Think about what Swami has shared with you on Sunday morning, this week. On your way home, tell yourself, hold on a second, I usually get angry a lot of the time. But hold on, anger, I always used to think that it was my children who made me angry. My wife makes me angry. My colleagues make me angry. My husband makes me angry. The next door neighbors make me angry. The dog that comes and does the poo-poo in front of my porch, it makes me angry. But no. Anger is not something that can be transferred from someone else to me. Anger happens within me. I cook it up. And now you need not accept what I'm saying at face value. Because I've given you evidence of that. See? Stop seeing this in green. If you can stop seeing this in green, then I will accept, if you can stop seeing this in green, okay, then I will accept that what you perceive is actually what's in the outside world, because this is not green. But you cannot stop seeing this in green, so then you will have to agree with me that what you perceive is totally the product of your own mind. If that is so, when you're angry, who's made you angry? Has anyone transferred that anger to you? Certainly not. You created it in your own mind. When you're feeling lustful, who transferred that to you? So what's the website that you can go on to have lustful thoughts? So what should you go into that one? Incognito mode? Private browsing? What for? See, once you realize that, lust is merely a creation of their own mind, Why do you want to look at a naked woman? What's there for me to get? If I cook it up in my own mind, you know, pornography is overrated. So if your son, if your daughter, if your husband or your wife, or maybe you yourself, still enjoys watching that kind of stuff, perhaps you have tried really hard to come out of it by promising yourself, observing precepts, taking a vow, right? And all these things that you've been trying to do, but they never worked. They never worked because you were just going round and round and round this cycle. You have to look for the exit. And here's the exit. Lust is not something that comes to you from www.com. You create it in your own mind. There's not a site out there that can trigger or that can create lust in your mind, ladies and gentlemen. You cook it up. Why does the mind cook it up? What is the mother of all invention? Necessity. When you have a necessity, your mind will always cook things up. Whatever that necessity is, the mind has to fulfill it. So the mind will cook it up. So when the mind desires lustful thoughts, the mind will create lust, will fabricate lust within itself, and then it will give credit to someone else for that. That's what it does. So actually, those performers in the strip clubs, they get paid for nothing. Because they haven't done anything to create lust in the minds of the audience. That was all cooked up by themselves. What about comedy? Let's take something on the other end of the spectrum. Comedy? What about comedy? Can Charlie Chaplin make you laugh? Can he? Comedy is also a creation of your own mind. See? If you're going to tell me that Charlie makes you laugh, then stop seeing this in green. I dare you. If you can stop seeing this in green, that day I will agree that what you see is what's in the outside world. But you can't. And green is not here, which means you have no idea what proportion of what you're seeing is from the outside world and what proportion of it is your own creation. So then we have no way of distinguishing how much of what is what. Therefore, we'll have to come to the agreement, because we can't come to that conclusion, it could potentially be all your mind's own doing. Potentially. You know, did you know that you cannot tickle yourself? You've all been tickled by someone, right? It's always by someone else, isn't it? Have you ever tried tickling yourself? Why does it not work? It's one of the best analogies I can offer you. Why can you not tickle yourself? Because that feeling of ticklishness is a creation of your own mind. That's why. If it was physical, you should be able to do it yourself. You want to experiment? And ask the person sat next to you to volunteer. No, don't. There'll be probably areas in your body which you claim are ticklish, right? Some people are under their underarms, maybe their feet, maybe their neck, behind their ears, wherever, right? People have different spots where they say are ticklish, right? Everyone has one? Yes. Can you tickle yourself? You can't. It is always someone else who has to tickle you. And when they do, you know, they can tickle you to death, can't they? We've all experienced that, you know, as kids, right, playing around with, just fooling around. But you can never tickle yourself, meaning it's not the physical touch that creates the ticklish sensation. Imagine it was your neck. Some people are ticklish in their neck, right? So if you did that, it does nothing to you. But if someone else did that, you feel all ticklish. Why? You have to think about it. Why? How, you know, where is this ticklishness cooked up? It's in the mind, and the mind cooks it up when the mind wants to cook it up. Now, in the same way, anger, jealousy, lust, greed, fear, love, resentment, all of these feelings, respect, devotion, all of these feelings, ladies and gentlemen, are all cooked up in your own mind, all by the mind itself. That's why I repeat, you are an island. Nothing ever came to you from the outside. Nothing's ever going to leave the island. You are an island. I want all of you to acknowledge that. Because once you have acknowledged that, then you take complete and total responsibility for your own salvation. Then and only then do you take complete accountability for all those emotions that you feel inside you. If you're the one who cooks it up, then you can stop cooking it. I agree, you don't do it deliberately. No one becomes afraid deliberately. Causes lead to that effect. But those causes are all internal. That's the point. All those causes are in your own mind. Those causes do not come from the outside. I'll give you yet another example. When you see your spouse, you have feelings of affection. When your children see him or her, they also have a feeling of affection. Are they the same? Certainly not. So, what is the right kind of affection that one must be feeling when they see that person? Which one's the right one? I'll explain it to you in real life example. Say the children's mother, that is your wife, or the children's father, that is your husband, right? So when you see your spouse, be that your husband or your wife, you have a certain kind of emotional response to that. Yes, you feel love, you feel affection, you feel all sorts of weird and wonderful feelings. When your children see their father or see their mother, they don't feel the same feelings, do they? They also feel affection, but in a very, very different kind of way. Yes? Okay. Now then the question to you is, which one's the right one? Which is the one that they give off? So when you're... Now here's the thing, right? So say you're at the dinner table. Right? So your wife is sat there as well. You are on this side, you're the husband, and on here they have you have your children. Okay? So you hold her hand, your children also hold her hand. And as you hold your wife's hand, you feel a sense of love, affection, all that, in a way that a husband would feel towards his wife. The children are holding their mother's hand, and they're also feeling love, affection, in a way that children would feel towards their mother. My question is to you is this. Mothers in the house, / wives in the house, which feeling are you giving off at that point? Which one are you giving off at that point? Are you sending some of those through your right arm and the other through your left arm? So which feeling are you giving off, the wife feeling or the mother feeling? Which affection are you sort of spreading out of your body so that the people who are holding your hands can feel them, their respective feeling, the ones that they're entitled to? Which feeling are you giving off? None whatsoever. So then how come your husband holds your hands and says, I know you love me. And I can feel it in the air. How come your children then hold your hand and say, Mommy, I know you love me. I can feel it. So I'm asking you again, which one are you giving off? So let's just say we blindfolded the two of them. We blindfold your husband, we blindfold your children. Right? And then now it's your turn. You can swap your arms around, do whatever. Right? Because on the right hand you're giving out spousal love. And the left arm you're giving out parental love. Right? So if you did that, you crossed your arms, and now your husband's holding your left arm, your children's holding your right arm. Are they all of a sudden going to feel, oh, hold on a second, that's the wrong kind of feeling. I should not be feeling this right now. Does it work like that? Does it? No. Then what does that tell you? It's all created in whose mind? The mind of the perceiver. So once again, I have to ask you, what is it that keeps you bound to your lay lives? Who is it that you cannot leave? Who are these people that love you so dearly and whose love without which you wouldn't be able to survive? Or are they all merely your own creations in your own mind because there's a necessity to feel that? That's why you experience them, ladies and gentlemen. When you have no such necessity, it doesn't matter how much they try to give you or show you that affection, you don't feel a tiny bit of it. When you're grieving about something, your friends might come up to you, they might stroke your head, you know, give you an embrace, but you just don't feel it because right now you're just going through grievance. It's only after you have vented all that grievance, are you now prepared to then start cooking up a new curry? Because you can't cook two curries in the same pot. That's why you don't feel fear and lust at the same time. You can't enjoy lust if you're scared of something. That's why you can't feel happy about your, I don't know, about something and sad about something at the same time. It's one or the other. You just failed your exams. Say an exam that you were really eyeing for. And you just got your results, you failed your exams. Mother bakes your favorite cake. Aren't you going to say, Mother, pick the wrong day? Just pick the wrong day. Any other day, and you would have been over the moon. So what is it that gave you that feeling? The cake? What is it that gave you that disappointment? The failure in the exams? No, all those emotions were self-made. The long and short of this lecture is this. I need all of you to take complete responsibility and accountability for all of your emotions and all of your feelings, because they're all mind-made. No one has ever to this day given you any love. Even if they did try it, you would still not be able to experience it. So aren't you an island? Who's your companion? Are you married? To whom? think, folks? Think. I was also once someone who was married. See, I first got married in my mind. Then I went looking for a partner to get married to. When I got to learn the Dhamma, I realized married, being married is a state of mind. Once I gave that up, I needn't have anyone around me. It was no longer necessary. Back then I was a fool. Read between the lines. Are you still married? Who are you married to? If you're going to tell me you're married to your wife, stop seeing this in green. Stop seeing this in green, and then I will accept that you're married to your wife. But until you can stop seeing this in green, I'll have to ask you the question, how do you know that this thing that's next to you is actually a person? And she's fair, or she's dark, or she's a she. How do you know? What if she's a he? Or what if she's a tree? How would you know? You can't stop seeing this in green. So what level of confidence with which can you say that what you're seeing is actually what's out there? You have no idea. Because all you perceive is what your consciousness allows you to perceive. Then the only thing you're married to is really yourself. You think you're married to your wife because you cook up your wife in your own mind. That's the person you're married to. You create an entity in your mind, an individual you create in your mind, and then you say, that's my wife. And then you look at an object. Then what you do is you project this creation onto that object. Here's how the mind works. You project your creation onto that object. And then you say, that's my wife out there. I keep saying wife. Wives do the same. It's the same story. Ultimately, you are the king and you're the only subject in your own mind. In this kingdom of yours, there's only one subject. He's the king and he's the subject. That's all. You are so alone, ladies and gentlemen. You are so alone. Atta hi atta no natti. Kuto putta kuto dhana. Where are your children? Where are your spouses? You cook them up in your own mind. Where are your friends? Where is you? You cook yourself up in your own mind. What about the others? What about the rest of them? That's why there's only one refuge, and that is the refuge of the Dhamma. Understanding this is your only companion. Understanding this truth. I am not your companion, don't get me wrong. I cannot be your companion. I'm only the messenger. I'm only here to give you the message. I'm only here to introduce you to the only refuge that you have, and that is not me. Because even I, you cook up in your mind. So when you walk up here and you make your veneration to Swami Nuhanse, you cook that up in your own mind. That Swami Nuhanse is actually here. What Swami Nuhanse? I'll tell you what's here. There's a body and there's a mind. But you say, you think this, that particular Swami Nuhanse is here. That is only a creation in your own mind. Yes, this mind might have certain virtues. It might have certain qualities. Yes. But this individual that you think is here, they're not here. Where are they? It's only in your mind. So if you want to worship me, do you have to come up here? Why not? Where am I? In whose mind? In your mind. Where's your mind? up here. That's only. So, where's the Buddha? Where's the Buddha? The Buddha's in your mind. So then, does the Buddha have to be present here today for you to make an offering? No. It has been 2,500 years since the Buddha's Parinibbana. Does he have to be here in person for you to make an offering to the Buddha? No, because where is the Buddha? In your mind. So make the offering to the Buddha that's in your mind. For that, where must you be? At the temple? Where? Tissa Maharam? Venuvanaram? Or Jetanaram? In your Arama, your monastery. Your monastery is in your own mind. So then people ask this question, why do we worship statues? That's a quick question that people we get a lot in Buddhism. Why do you make offerings to statues? Why do you put flowers down in front of a statue? Because not everyone understands this. This profound concept that the Buddha is only created in one's own mind. Once you understand this, you don't need to lay down flowers in front of a Buddha. Because what is a flower even? That's also a creation of the mind. So then you can create your flowers, you can create the Buddha and put the flowers in front of the Buddha, all in your own mind. And you earn the same amount of merits, did you know that? It doesn't have to be a physical statue and it doesn't have to be a physical flower. Because merit is not what the hands do. It's not what the legs do. It's not what your body does. It's what the mind does. So then why do we do this though? It's to symbolize. So we don't worship idols. Of course not. This is only a representation of that. When your mother passed away, did you not put a photo of her at home and put a garland or something around it, or say your grandmother passed away? Is that your grandmother? But you have a picture of her at home, don't you? It's only to symbolize. Because that sight reminds you. So this sight reminds you to create the Buddha in your mind. Because if it were not for that sight, if it were not for that statue, you'd be thinking of whatever was put in front of your eyes. So if someone showed you a tree, you'd be thinking of the tree. But someone shows you a statue, now you're thinking of the Buddha. That's what we use statues and idols for. Not to worship the idol. Not to worship the statue. Because there's nothing in the statue that is worthy of worship. That's just a bit of clay. Or maybe stone. Or maybe wood. That's all. We don't worship stones or rocks or wood or any of that. But we worship the Buddha. The Buddha happens in the mind. Does that make sense to you? So how much must you have to make an offering? You need nothing. Because you can do it all in your mind. So then why do we make offerings then? Physical offerings, why do we do that? Why don't we just all do it mentally? Now we'll all just stay at home, we don't need dakineya, we don't need any of that. We can just all do it in our own minds. Well, although the mind doesn't need the physical thing, the body still needs the requisites. You can sew a robe in your mind and offer it to Swami Nuhansi, but I can't wear that robe, can I? That robe needs to come in physical form. Right? So you can bring alms food in your mind and offer it. When I come on alms round, you can do it in your mind. That's good for you. But my stomach is still hungry. And if I don't put anything into the stomach, then I'll fall, I'll become weak, and I'll become ill. And then I will not be able to teach you what I just taught you. That you don't need to offer physical alms, you could do it all in your mind. But that's why we do the physical part. Because we are all born with bodies. You just imagine if we were all just minds and we didn't come with a physical body, then you would need not make any offering whatsoever. Then you don't need any offering whatsoever. You don't need to offer any food, you don't need to offer any robes, you don't need to offer any shelter, you don't need to offer any of that sort, no medicines, nothing. But you do it because you understand that Swami Mahasaya comes in a physical form. So this body has to sustain his mind until he has done what he has to do and continues to share the truth with all of us so that we can do what we have to do. But that's why we make the physical offerings. Does that make sense? There you go. But anyhow, what I want to get across to you today through this talk was this. You create everything in your own mind. All these feelings, all these emotions, negative and positive, all that is all created in your own mind. To break out of this endless loop, you have to first acknowledge that whatever you perceive are all your mental formations. These are all mental creations. Once you do that, ladies and gentlemen, you will take complete responsibility and accountability for what you perceive. It is then you will start to ask the next question. Swami Nahansa, there are some emotions I don't really like because they hurt me. They're painful. What can I do? Until you acknowledge that these emotions are all made within the mind, you will not need to ask me that question because you will already be looking to others or at others, fighting with them, shouting at them, picking a fight with them, telling them off because you think that it is others who are responsible for you feeling that way. That's why I say if you have an addiction to anything, mentally, that addiction itself is a creation of the mind. We can stop that once you begin to understand how the mind works. If you cannot break out of an addiction, let's say to the example we used earlier, pornography, and that's because this you enjoy lustful feelings to some extent, let's say, and you think that it comes to you from watching whatever on screen. No, they don't come to you from that. You cook it up in your own mind. Once you realize that, right, the value that you give it drops. It's like a tickle. It's like a tickle. You tickle yourself and it doesn't work. You have to cook it up in your mind. When someone else does that, now you create it in your mind. Something that you don't do when you do it yourself physically. Does that make sense? Can you contemplate on what we just talked about at least for the next few days? Just reflect on that. When you walk outside and you see whatever you see, ladies and gentlemen, right? Like I asked you, is this color, is this leaf green? Right? When you see these objects as you walk around the street, right? Things that you see, things that you hear, ask yourself this question, am I seeing and perceiving something that's coming to me from the outside world, or am I actually perceiving something that I'm cooking up in my own mind? Realize that you're just an island. Contemplate on that. To realize that you're just an island. And whenever you feel emotions, like let's say you get home today, you greet your family, and you know they want to share affection with you. You will feel affection, no less. But at that point, please remember what Swami Nahansa taught you this morning. And remind yourself, hold on, I'm feeling affection right now, yes, but that's not something my son just gave me. It's not something my beloved husband just gave me. It's something I cooked up in my own mind. Do you understand what I'm saying? You get scared of something. You see a cockroach, maybe you're scared of cockroaches. You see the cockroach and it startles you, you jump back. Okay? In that moment, yes, you get scared. Or maybe there's a frog jumps at you. In that moment, you're scared. Okay. But at least a few moments later, try and recall what Swami Nahansa explained to you today. and tell yourself, wait, that fear was not something that the cockroach gave me or the frog gave me. If it were, then the cockroach should be running around trying to escape itself, shouldn't it? It's always there with it. And the frog should just be jumping around trying to run away from itself if frogs were so scary. So that's something you cook up in your own mind. So once you take responsibility for all those emotions that you feel internally, at that point we can have a conversation. There are some emotions that you don't like. They hurt you, they torment you, they bring you anguish and pain. Then I can explain to you what the causes are that lead to the manifestation of those emotions. Then we can start working on them. But until then, there's no point in me trying to convince you that ignorance and attachment are the root causes of your suffering. Can you do that? Trial that, experiment that, try that for the course of the next few days. That is meditation. That is one of the best kinds of meditation. See, for that you don't need to sit down cross-legged or with your eyes closed. Open your eyes, see what you see, hear what you hear, taste what you taste. When you have some cake this evening after dinner and you experience the taste of sweetness or sourness or whatever, ask yourself the question, is that in the cake or is that me creating it in my own mind? And then ask yourself the question, how do I know I'm actually eating anything at all? If all of this is created in my own mind, then how do I know I'm eating a cake at all? There's only one thing you know for certain. You're perceiving, that's it. You don't even know what you're perceiving is the truth or not. You're perceiving, that's it. That you can be certain of, you're perceiving. Whether you're perceiving what is actually in the outside world or not, who knows? But does it matter? No. All we need to understand today is that what you perceive is your consciousness. What you're conscious of is your perception. Simple as that. Shall we leave it for today? So we've given you some homework. Now today is the day that we go out on alms round. So, as I've explained to you, if you want to worship Swami Nuhansay, where can you do it from? You can do it from wherever you are. Because once it's gone past 12, I can't go on alms round anyway. So those days we just skip. But we try and give people an opportunity to earn some merits by making some offering, because they think, I'm the Swami Nuhansay. So they are incapable yet of making an offering in their own homes, in their own minds. So they have to see the figure of a monk with his arms bowed walking along the street for them to actually be inspired to make that initial offering. Once they do that a few times, they will earn enough merits to come here to some kind of gathering like this. And then they'll be able to listen to the Dhamma. Thanks to the offerings that they had made. Remember, you don't get merits for transferring the food. It's not the food that carries the merits. It's the mind, the thought. That's what earns the merits. That's why we always say, ladies and gentlemen, whenever you make an offering, do try and not make that a personal offering. Whenever you make an offering, offer it to the Mahasangha. Where is the Mahasangha? That's what I'm saying. In your mind. Whenever you make an offering, try and make it an offering not even just to an arahant. An arahant is only one member of the Mahasangha. It is the entirety of the Sangha, which includes the Buddha and all Buddhas that have been in the past. All Rahatanvans is where that have been in the past and the future. So whenever you make an offering, do try and not make it a personal offering to the Swami Nuhansay who's here, or anywhere for that matter. Do try and make that offering to the Mahasangha. I ask you to do that because when you do that, the power of your merit is multiplied and magnified tremendously in comparison to the little that you will earn by making that offering just to an individual. Remember that individual is also not here. That individual is also in your mind. There are two parts that contribute. One is what's in the outside world. The other is what's in your mind. You cannot change what's here. Right? Because I can't bring the Buddha here to accept your offering. I am the one who's here today to accept your offering. But in your mind, you can shift your thinking. And rather than making that offering to an individual, offer it to the Mahasangha. That way, your contribution is at its fullest. On my side, this is the best you're going to get for today. And that's why when you come to the monastery, you can earn more merits that way. Because here, there's only one individual. At the monastery, when you make an offering, typically you even tend to think that it's actually for the entire community of the Sangha, right? It's a great environment for you to feel that way. But even when you are here, if you are making an offering, in your mind, offer it to the Mahasangha. Because I have been permitted by the Buddha to accept offerings on behalf of the Mahasangha. As I have that permission, why not make the most of it? Is the invitation I make to you. As I have his permission to accept what has been offered to the Mahasangha, why don't you make the most of it? And rather than just offer something to an individual monk, I'm not suggesting that there's no merits in making a personal offering. There are merits in making a personal offering. But remember, that is it is limited by, well, it's limited to that. That's what I mean. It's limited to that. So you don't need to limit yourself when you can have the ocean. Why settle for a glass of water? Okay? So if there's something you wish to share with Swami Nuhanse particularly, then please feel free to come up. Or if there's something you wish to offer, then again, please feel free to come up. But if not, now you are fully entitled to and capable of making your veneration from wherever you are. And the only reason I'm suggesting we do that on the first Sunday of every month is so that it will save Swami Nuhanse some time to go an alms round. Otherwise, if it runs too late, then we will not be able to give that the gift of giving to those innocent souls who still need an extra bit of us going the extra mile, literally, to accept their alms. Okay? Right, let's leave it there then. So let us all take a moment then to transfer the merits that we have all acquired by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, creating a conducive environment for all to come along and practice the Dhamma, listen to the teachings of the Buddha, and attain to their liberation. First and foremost, let us take a moment to transfer this merits to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us take a moment to transfer this mace to the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer this mace to the Mahanayakas and the Anunayakas, theras of all the chapters throughout the world who have dedicated their lives to the noble path and to proliferate the Buddha's asana. Let us also take a moment to transfer this message to my teacher, Guru Swami Nuhanse, as well as all the monks resident to the monastery and the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer this message to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others or inviting others to join them. May they all rejoice in these merits. And by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer this merits to friends of the monastery, our devotees, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone among you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to your mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, friends, acquaintances, employers, employees, as well as teachers and anyone and everyone who have helped you, supported you and assisted you in any way, shape or form. May they all rejoice in all these merits that we have acquired today. And by the power of these merits, may they also be freed of any physical and mental ailments and to overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the devas and brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to fulfill the Sambhadasasana and preserving the Sambhadasasana. Let us transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who have passed away in our name, our loved ones, our forefathers, our ancestors, reminding ourselves that it is in the blood, sweat and tears they have shed. Today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life and practice the path in peace and harmony. Let us also transfer these merits to members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrifice their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as those who have lost their lives in the wars, be their friend or foe. Let us also transfer this message to those who have lost their lives to natural disasters and calamities such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on, reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will have been mothers and fathers to us, friends to us, supporters of ours, with an abundance of kindness and compassion towards all of them. Let us transfer all the merits we have acquired to all. May, by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful planes, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May, by the power of these merits, they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we will witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And may you and I, and everyone who's helped make this program a success, become a rahatan mahanse or an arahataranin mahanse in this very life itself and in the era of this Sambhadasasana itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. And the members of the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you. Raga ginnen midetma, dvesha ginnen midetma, moha ginnen midetma, nibbana parama sukhayan, Sukhita Taravetma Nibbana Parama Sukhayan Sukhita Taravetma Mamada Siyalu Loka Siyalu Satmayo Nibbana Parama Sukhayan Sukhita Taravetma Nibbana Parama Sukhayan Sukhita Taravetma Nibbana Parama Sukhayan Sukhita Taravetma Raga Gini Niveva Desha Gini Niveva Moha Gini Niveva Nivan Sapa Leveva Nivan Sapa Leveva Nivan Sapa Leveva Tundruange Suvisi Ananta Mahaguna Belen Siru Loka Siru Satyoma Nibbana Paramasukhen Suvidhitaravitva Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.